Chapter 1. The Diagnosis. Christmas Holidays. Christmas Day had arrived at last. Charlotte and Victoria couldn't wait to do their concert for the family. Aged 5 and 3, they just loved to entertain. We even made posters and displayed them around our home to advertise the Charlotte and Victoria show. Marshall, who at 7 years old was more interested in playing with his Lego, reluctantly sat down to watch the show. Alexandra, 13 months old, was having her afternoon sleep, and so was oblivious to all the commotion. My husband Ken and I sat down anticipating what our stage-bound daughters would amuse us with this afternoon. A week later, after the New Year's Eve celebrations to welcome in 2011, we headed off to Lemon Tree Passage at Port Stephens, New South Wales. Wonderful family memories were created. The children spent hours riding around on their bikes. After returning from Lemon Tree Passage, we headed down to the Sydney Aquarium to see the Lego exhibition. While we were walking around, Victoria kept saying, "I can't walk properly," and she was constantly falling over. After telling her numerous times, "Just slow down and watch where you're going," I stopped and studied how she was walking. What I saw was a bit concerning. Victoria had virtually no control over her left foot. When she took a step with her left leg, her foot turned completely inwards. Her left foot was at right angles to her right foot. Victoria had no strength to point the left foot forward. Well, how bad did I feel with my "just slow down and watch where you're going" comment? Clearly, there was something amiss with her foot or her hip or her leg. Or so we thought. On the way home from Sydney, Ken and I discussed the course of action. Being a Saturday night, our local doctor's surgery was closed, so we decided that as soon as we got home, Ken would take Victoria to a nearby after-hours medical centre. They returned from the medical centre with instructions to come back on Sunday morning and get a hip x-ray. On Tuesday, I took Victoria to the medical centre to get the x-ray results. The doctor advised that all looked fine in the x-ray. However, as the walking problem was still evident, he advised me to get an ultrasound of Victoria's left hip. We were able to get the ultrasound done on site immediately at the medical centre. Her hip looked normal. The doctor advised that we return in a couple of weeks so he could review her walking. That sounded like a reasonable course of action to me at the time. Wednesday, the 19th of January, 2011. The very next afternoon, we met up with some friends at the beach. It was a glorious day. As we were walking to the park at the beach, my very observant friend, who is a nurse, asked me, "What's going on with Victoria's walking?" I nonchalantly replied, "Oh, well, we've been to the doctor and he thinks it's some kind of hip problem. So we're just waiting to see what happens over the next few weeks." My gracious friend said to me, "I think there's something else happening. Can you see how her left shoulder is drooping too?" "Oh yes," I replied, still blissfully unaware of what that critical observation meant. We chatted for half an hour about other events going on in our lives. Then my friend tactfully said to me, "I think you should take Victoria to your GP in the morning to get her looked at again." "Okay," I replied, "if you think so." Then my beautiful friend offered to come over and look after the other children while I took Victoria to the doctor. At this point, I started to feel a little uneasy. I wondered why my friend was offering to help look after the other children. Couldn't they just come with me like they normally do? I phoned my GP and made an appointment for the next morning. So, with a plan in place, the children played in the surf for another hour or so before we packed up and left for home. On the 30-minute drive home, my friend's carefully chosen words continually went round and round in my head. The look of concern on her face, even though she tried to hide it, filled my mind. Why was she so concerned about Victoria? Why did she want to come over and look after the children while I took Victoria to our GP? By the time I was 5 minutes away from home, I had worked myself into quite a distressed state. I decided not to wait until the morning to find out what was wrong with Victoria, but rather thought I would seek advice from a friend's husband who was a doctor. I knew he'd know what we needed to do. So I drove straight past our house, parked in their driveway, and ran up to the front door. With tears rolling down my face, I said, "There's something wrong with Victoria." Once again, the grace shown to me was unforgettable. My husband's friends did a few observations on Victoria and then spoke briefly to his wife. He told me to take Victoria to the John Hunter Hospital straight away, and when I got there, I was to tell the emergency department staff that he had checked Victoria out and said she needed to be seen immediately. Ken was on his way to Melbourne for a business trip, so my friend kindly offered to look after our other three children at home. By this time, I was desperately concerned about Victoria. I was still unsure as to what was going on with her, but getting a very strong impression from my friends that it was something really serious. We left the medical centre only one day ago with the "just come back in 4 to 6 weeks," and now I was being told Victoria needs to go to the hospital straight away. My mind was racing while I was trying to stay calm for Victoria's sake. I had never been to the John Hunter Hospital before. I didn't even know where to park, let alone know where the emergency department was. I finally managed to get a park in the car park furthest away from the emergency department. Victoria had to walk as best she could along a seemingly endless corridor. When we eventually found the emergency department, I explained to the triage nurse what had happened and mentioned our doctor friend's name. The staff swung into action rather quickly and we were whisked into the emergency rooms. By this time, it was 7 o'clock at night. Thankfully, Victoria had asked to bring a balloon from the car into the hospital. The balloon provided hours of entertainment, actually 4 hours, as she was assessed by numerous doctors. Lots of strength tests were performed, including Victoria wrapping her fingers around the doctor's fingers and squeezing tight, pushing the sole of her feet against the doctor's hands. There was plenty of testing Victoria's arms and legs with the reflex hammer too. Around 11 o'clock that evening, a neurologist came to see us. It was her first day at John Hunter Hospital. She said to me, "We're arranging for Victoria to have a CT scan tonight." I was beginning to understand that this was a much bigger problem than Victoria being unable to walk properly. Preparation for the CT scan included the insertion of a cannula into her hand, a traumatic experience for both her and me. Finally, at midnight, we walked into the room with the CT scanner. Victoria was still awake, chatting to everyone. As she lay on the bed to go into the machine, I stood beside her with a protective vest on. I prayed, "God, please give her and us the strength to get through this, whatever the outcome." As I now reflect on the moment, there was some similarity to when in the book of Genesis in the Bible, Abraham put Isaac on the altar. Genesis chapter 22, verses 12 to 14 from the Message Bible says this: "Don't lay a hand on that boy. Don't touch him. Now I know how fearlessly you fear God. You didn't hesitate to place your son, your dear son, on the altar for me." Abraham looked up. He saw a ram, caught it by its horns in the thicket. Abraham took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. Abraham named that place God Yiri, God sees to it. And that's where we get the saying, "On the mountain of God, he sees to it." Of course, there's one big difference between my story and Abraham's story. Abraham laid Isaac on the altar in obedience to God. I had laid Victoria out on the bed of the CT scanner, which may as well have been an altar, at the request of the neurologist. However, we were both in a position of having to trust God completely with the life of our children. We had to trust that God would see to it. When the CT scan was finished, the neurologist walked us back to a room in the emergency department. Not a curtained bay like the one we were originally in, but a proper room with a door that could be shut. During the scan, Victoria had finally fallen asleep and was blissfully unaware of the words that were about to be spoken. I sat looking at my child, thinking, thankfully, she has gone to sleep. She'll be so tired tomorrow. The neurologist came in and simply said, the CT scan showed there is a mass in your child's brain. No! I screamed and started to sob. The neurologist explained the next steps to me, which included an MRI in the morning. Frankly, I cannot remember much else of what she said. All I was thinking was, how can this be? This child is so well and healthy. Why didn't we notice this before? Was there something we could have done to detect this earlier? However, I do remember these words from the neurologist and am very grateful for them. If you'd brought her here earlier, last week or last month, it would have made no difference. By saying that, she immediately removed any feelings of guilt regarding us not reacting quickly enough to the symptoms Victoria had been displaying. I couldn't contemplate phoning Ken in Melbourne with this news. I asked the neurologist to call him and explain it all to him as I sat there in complete shock. Ken was aware that we were at the hospital, as on the way here, I'd phoned both him and my mother to let them know we were going to get Victoria's leg problem sorted out. But now we were facing a completely different scenario. After 10 minutes or so, I managed to summon the strength to phone my mum in New Zealand. All I could say to her was, Mum, I need you here now. Being the wonderful mother she is, she was on the first plane out of New Zealand the next morning. Victoria was moved from the emergency department and taken down to the J1 Children's Oncology Ward to spend the night there. Our first of many. She didn't get much sleep due to the required 4-hourly observations. As for my night's sleep, I can't really remember if I got any sleep or not. Perhaps I had a couple of hours from sheer emotional exhaustion. For anyone who's wondering if we took any action regarding the initial misdiagnosis of Victoria's illness, in February 2011 we did lodge a complaint with the Healthcare Complaints Commission. The main outcome we wanted was for the doctor to be aware of his misdiagnosis, with the view to preventing future misdiagnosis of brain tumours when physical symptoms are present. From subsequent correspondence with the Healthcare Complaints Commission, it appears that this outcome was achieved. Thursday, the 20th of January 2011. On Thursday morning, the doctors were milling around the nurse's station outside Victoria's room, studying her CT scans. I say doctors as there are about 8 of them. They were chatting among themselves about what would be the best course of action. I was a bit taken aback by such an open-air discussion. Having worked in the corporate sphere prior to having children, I was used to meetings of any significance being held behind closed doors. Clearly, that was not the approach taken here. The nurse's station in the middle of the ward was the place where it all happened. I stood by, trying to glean what information I could. One doctor's comments stick in my mind. It was something like, we should do an MRI of her spine as well as her brain, just in case there is anything there too. Hearing that was too much for me. I retreated back to Victoria's room and continued distracting her from the frustration of not being able to eat or drink. The MRI of the brain and spine required Victoria to lie completely still for about 40 minutes. This was a big ask for a 3-year-old. So the doctors arranged for her to have a general anaesthetic just prior to the MRI. This meant that she was assigned kneel-by-mouth status until the scan had been completed. Victoria had not eaten or drunk anything since 5 p.m. the previous day. Finally, at 2 p.m. she had the MRI. Needless to say, it was a very long and tedious day, filled with hours of placating and finding creative distractions. My mum arrived just after the scan was completed. How wonderful it was to have Mum there so she could take over the care of Victoria while I sat with the doctors. There was another meeting at the nurse's station. This time I wasn't on the fringes, but sitting right in the middle of the meeting, being given all the details of what was happening in Victoria's brain. There was no retreating now. One of the doctors said to me, "This is a very unusual tumour in a very unusual place." Those weren't exactly the words I wanted to hear. It appeared the tumour was 3 to 4 centimetres in size, sort of like a golf ball. It was low to the right of the centre in Victoria's brain, positioned on or attached to the brainstem. The tumour was pressing on the right side of her brain. The pressure was causing left side weakness, meaning reduced strength in her leg, foot, arm, and hand on the left side. Hence the reason she had been having so much difficulty walking. One of the biggest concerns the doctors had was how to access the tumour while doing minimal damage to her brain. The surgeon was going to have to canvass opinions on the best surgical approach from experts around the world. My sister, her husband, and child arrived at the hospital during this meeting. I'll never forget the relief I felt when I saw her walk into the ward, pushing her child's stroller down the corridor. We needed support. Our world was turning upside down. After hearing all the doctors had to say, I asked a close friend to pray with me. We went to the quiet room in the Ronald McDonald family room. What a blessing that room was to us during those 2 weeks in the hospital. A lot of prayers were prayed there. As soon as we sat down in the room, I put my head in my hands and sobbed and sobbed. I literally cried out to God, "Please, God, we need a miracle. I know this little girl is your daughter and she is on loan to us. Please give these doctors wisdom." During that time of being utterly distraught, this psalm came to mind. Psalm 20, verse 5. "May we shout for joy over your victory and lift up our banners in the name of our God. May the Lord grant all your requests." Around 8 o'clock that night, Ken arrived back from Melbourne. He came straight from the Newcastle Airport to the hospital. We hugged, cried, and prayed. Friday, the 21st of January, 2011. It was decided that Victoria would have brain surgery the following week. Brain surgery is certainly not minor surgery. One doctor told us that the best scenario from the operation was that the tumour would just pop out cleanly, leaving no damage to Victoria's brain. The worst scenario would be that as they cut into the tumour, it would bleed out and Victoria would die. Or the outcome could be something in the middle of these two scenarios. We had no choice but to wait and pray. Later that morning, we met with a social worker. Well, actually the head of the social work department, as the paediatric social worker was on leave. He was the perfect person to help us. He spoke to us about many things, including gently telling us that this would be a long journey, and that every step along the way we would have new things to deal with. He also said that we didn't both have to be in the hospital 24 hours, 7 days a week, unless something critical was happening. This was very releasing for both of us to hear. He spoke about the importance of having other adult support both at home and at the hospital, especially until we knew what the treatment plan was going to be. Thankfully, we had that one covered with the amazing support of family, friends, neighbours, church and school. We also discussed the practicalities of having a seriously ill child, the impact on family finances and support services available to help with electricity bills, telephone bills, car registration, etc. One of the most practical pieces of advice he gave us was to be at the hospital by 9 a.m. so we could get a car park. He gave us some insight into the behaviours we could expect from our other children, such as separation anxiety and an increased dependence upon Ken and me. His advice to us was to let them talk, trust in their ability to adapt, and keep it simple. He reminded us that it was important we take time out as a couple and keep trying to do normal family things. The social worker also spoke to us about our possible reactions to the situation. He helped us to understand that we would each react differently, and that was okay. The important thing was that we respect each other's reactions. It was another very wise piece of advice, as I am an internal processor, while Ken is an external processor. I wanted to hide in a room and share my thoughts and fears with God alone. Ken wanted to get on the phone and share the updates and his fears with family and friends. Both approaches were valid. We needed to acknowledge our differences, be gracious with each other, and give each other the freedom to manage our emotions our own way. After this meeting, I had a whole new appreciation for social workers. Having never come into contact with them before, I got a glimpse of how very valuable their role was, giving support and advice of times of crisis. The social worker also met with some of our extended family, which not only acknowledged their important role as carers of us, but also offered them much needed support. At Friday lunchtime, as Victoria was healthy in every other way, the doctors told us we could take her home for the next 5 days. How grateful we were to hear those words. We couldn't get out of the hospital fast enough, so we could be in our own familiar environment and regroup as a family. The doctors said we had to return to the hospital immediately if Victoria started having headaches or vomiting. What a blessing it was to walk out of the hospital that afternoon. We knew there was a very challenging road ahead, but we also knew that we now had potentially 5 days in which we could be a normal family. We did not know what our future would hold past next Thursday, the day of Victoria's brain surgery. As we drove home from the hospital, with the social worker's comments in mind about doing normal family things, Ken and I discussed what we'd like to do in those 5 days to create the best family memories possible. We agreed on these three activities. Firstly, for Charlotte and Victoria to give us a rerun of their Christmas Day concert. Secondly, go to church as a family and have the elders pray for Victoria. And thirdly, go to the beach with our extended family, most of who were now either with us or on their way to visit. Reflection. The importance of a shared faith when the going gets tough. Ken and I had been married for about 12 and a half years when Victoria was diagnosed. Prior to our marriage, Ken shared his Christian faith very openly with me. He was very blunt on a couple of occasions, saying, "Your life is a mess. You need God." I found this quite offensive, and for a while I would literally run the other way when I saw him. I did have some knowledge of God. When I was a child, growing up in New Zealand, my mother had taken me to church and I'd started to develop a relationship with God. However, Marxist feminist teaching at university strongly influenced me, and in my late teens, I stopped praying and stopped going to church. So, when Ken started talking to me about God, I simply said, "I'm not interested," and changed the conversation. I had my own thoughts on life. I was one of those Kiwis who, in my early 20s, moved to Sydney looking for work. After 4 years of working extremely hard and enjoying life in Sydney's eastern suburbs, I achieved my goal of buying an Art Deco apartment in Sydney's Elizabeth Bay. I couldn't wait to move in and feel the satisfaction of attaining my goal. Well, what a shock I got. As I lay in my bed in my apartment on the first night, I realised I didn't feel any different to the night before when I was in the rental accommodation. The disappointment I felt was immense. A voice inside my head kept asking, "Why do I feel so empty after all my hard work?" Around that same time, I attended a corporate retreat where we were asked to assess each area of our life. I was able to score 10 out of 10 for every area in my life, except spirituality. To be completely honest, I had to put a zero in that box. Being a task-focused person, I thought I'd better fix this. However, little did I know that God was already on the case. The lady that gave me my first job in Sydney was a Christian. She had been praying for me diligently every day for 3 years. As I searched for something to fill that spiritual void, I kept hearing that voice in my head saying, "What is your life about, Wendy? Buying the apartment didn't bring the satisfaction you were looking for. What is your vision? What is your life's purpose?" I couldn't answer these questions. I was gradually coming to the realization that I didn't feel satisfied with my life. It felt empty. I had no vision and no purpose. One day, while walking to work, I eventually yielded to that still small voice. I called out to Jesus, "Okay, I give up doing life my way. I'll do it your way." Immediately, I felt the peace that I had thought buying the apartment would bring me. It was a true moment of revelation. I knew I was now on the right path, the path to a purposeful life. Later that day, I phoned Ken and asked if I could go to church with him. 3 weeks later, we were dating. 18 months later, we were married. At our wedding in June 1998, a friend, Neil Joseph, gave us one of his beautiful paintings entitled "Come to the Garden." On the back of the painting, he had made reference to some scriptures, including one from Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verses 9 to 12. "Two are better than one, because they have a good, more satisfying reward for their labor. For if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie down together, then they have warmth. But how can one be warm alone? And though a man might prevail against him who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken." How true this scripture has been for our marriage. There have been many times since Victoria was diagnosed when Ken and I did not know what was going to happen next. There was nothing practical we could do to change or improve Victoria's circumstance. We each responded very differently to the crisis, but there was one effective thing we could always do, and we could do it together. Pray. As marriage counsellors Dennis and Barbara Rainey said, "God intends for marriage to be a spiritual relationship consisting of three, not just a man and a woman, but the two of them and their God relating spiritually and remaining committed to each other for a lifetime. Wouldn't it be natural for God, the one who initiated the relationship, to want a couple to bring their troubles, worries, and praises to him on a regular daily basis? I wonder how our responses would have differed if we hadn't shared the same faith. For a start, we wouldn't have been able to pray together. I can picture the conversation or conflict now. "Why are you bothering to pray? What difference will that make? There isn't anybody listening." Praise God, we had already worked through that basic truth 14 years before, and God had brought us together in complete unity. We wouldn't have been able to genuinely quote scripture to each other as we prayed. Philippians 4 verse 6 to 7 was a favorite. "Do not fret or have any anxiety about anything, but in every circumstance and in everything, by prayer and petition, definite requests, with thanksgiving, continue to make your wants known to God. And God's peace shall be yours, that tranquil state of a soul assured of its salvation through Christ, and so fearing nothing from God and being content with its earthly lot of whatever sort that is, that peace, which transcends all understanding, shall garrison and mount guard over your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus." If we hadn't been looking to the same source for the answers, it would have been challenging to trust that the decisions we were making were the right ones. We would have been relying on our own incomplete and differing knowledge rather than submitting to God and His will. We wouldn't have shared and encouraged each other with that deep knowing that God was with us in this situation, regardless of how devastating it seemed. We can look back now and see that God had been preparing us for this time. Prior to Victoria's diagnosis, our marriage had been good, but nowhere near perfect. We had gone through two miscarriages after Marshall's birth and had to learn how to deal with grief and disappointment. We had come to a place where we had the faith to believe that God would give us more children. And He did. three more, born almost 2 years and 2 weeks apart, Charlotte in September 2005, Victoria in October 2007, and Alexandra in November 2009, making our family complete. Financially, we had experienced times of struggle as we navigated through the tribulations of owning a small business. Both these times and many others had taught us the value of prayer, as well as the importance of coming together in unity with thanksgiving and submitting our requests to God, especially in the times when we could do or say nothing other than, "Please help us, God. We don't know what to do." God would always answer, most often not as we expected. For 14 years, we had been learning how to wait for God's perfect timing, although we didn't always wait patiently and peacefully, but we waited. Stormy O'Martian talks about this in her book, The Power of a Praying Wife, actually one of the first books I read when we got married. While Stormy is specifically talking about husbands and marriage, I believe these principles apply to all our prayers. Above all, don't give place to impatience. Seeing answers to your prayers can take time, especially if your marriage is deeply wounded or strained. Be patient to persevere and wait for God to heal. Keep in mind that you are both imperfect people. Only the Lord is perfect. Look to God as the source of all you want to see happen in your marriage, and don't worry about how it will happen. It's your responsibility to pray. It's God's job to answer. Leave it in His hands. I am grateful to God that He used Ken and other precious people to bring me to a place of repentance and acknowledgement of my need for Jesus in my life. I am grateful that He chose Ken to be my husband, as God knew all those years ago when we married what was to come. He knew that our faith and trust in Him needed to be strengthened so that when this challenge came into our lives, we would go to only one place, Him, and that we would go together. Matthew 18, verses 19 to 20 says this: "I also tell you this, if two of you agree here on earth concerning anything you ask, my Father in heaven will do it for you. For where two or three gather together as my followers, I am there among them."